welcome to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. On today's program, we'll have a special report on Colombia. We'll present an exclusive interview with the international spokesperson of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, Latin America's oldest guerrilla organization. We'll also have two reports on the fallout from the murder of Colombia's former defense minister, a conservative hawk who was opposed to any negotiation with the country's rebel groups, as well as Washington's announcement to revoke the visas of several generals from the Colombian armed forces. Later in the program, we'll have a report on the state of the Guatemalan peace accords and how the government may be failing to implement some of the most important provisions of the 1996 treaty. And finally, we'll take a brief look at the life of José Francisco Peña Gómez, the longtime leader of the Dominican Revolutionary Party, who died at the age of 61 on May 11th. All of this and more coming up next, but first here are some stories making headlines this week in Our Americas.
With news from Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krugman. Paraguay's ruling party is celebrating its continued hold on power after last-minute Colorado candidate Raúl Cubas Grau won the May 10th presidential elections. 53-year-old Cubas, who garnered about 60% of the votes tallied, won with a clear majority over the opposition Democratic Alliance challenger Domingo Laino. This election marks the first peaceful transition from one civilian president to another since the overthrowing of Paraguay's military dictatorship in 1989. Cubas was initially the vice presidential running mate of former Army strongman General Lino Oviedo, who won the Colorado Party's primary last fall. Oviedo, charged with a coup attempt against exiting President Juan Carlos Vasmosi, was forced out of the race as the Paraguayan Supreme Court upheld a 10-year jail sentence for the presidential hopeful.
The Italian government is demanding an explanation after Mexico's May 11th dawn expulsion of 40 Italian human rights observers, including four legislators from an indigenous community in Chiapas. The 40 observers were part of a contingent of 132 Italians who infuriated the Mexican government by marching through an immigration checkpoint on May 6th and visiting Taniperlas, an autonomous community created by Zapatista supporters. Only 10 had the government's permission to go. Calling them professional provocateurs, the Mexican government banned the 40 defiant observers from Mexico for life, while the other 92, who left before their visas expired, are prohibited from returning for 10 years. The Cedillo administration has expelled 260 foreign human rights observers from Chiapas in the last 29 months under a law prohibiting foreigners from meddling in Mexico's politics. Human rights groups are charging that the Mexican government is protecting murderous paramilitary groups in the area by expelling witnesses to the crackdown on rebel supporters in the embattled state.
In Honduras, the leader of a banana workers' movement who fought a U.S. company for using toxic pesticides was shot to death on May 10th. Authorities said that two gunmen attacked 53-year-old Medardo Varela in his hometown of Sabá, 175 miles north of the capital of Tegucigalpa. Police say they had no further details. Varela fought for compensation for over 5,000 Honduran banana workers who were exposed to DBCP, a pesticide banned in the United States in 1977 after studies showed it caused sterility, blindness, and cancer. DBCP was used from 1968 to 1980 on plantations owned by San Francisco-based Castle and Cook, which has operated in Honduras as Standard Fruit Company since 1899. It has also been used on plantations owned by Cincinnati-based Chiquita Brands. According to the Honduran government, some 8,000 workers had been exposed to the toxic pesticide over a 12-year period on these plantations. None had any protection, nor were any of them informed of the potential damage to their health. Due in part to Varela's efforts, last year, seven U.S. companies agreed to pay a total of $41.5 million to 14,000 plantation workers in Latin America, the Caribbean, Asia, and Africa who claimed the use of pesticides made them sterile. Under the agreement, 3,000 Hondurans affected by the chemical received $100 each.
Brazil is feeling the pressure from human and child labor rights groups to put its words into action. On May 13th, thousands of children marched to Brazil's Congress to demand an end to child labor and to urge lawmakers to speed up passing measures to improve the observance of human rights. Participating in a global march against child labor, the children streamed into a congressional conference to hand in a letter denouncing child labor and demanding better rights for the estimated 2 million children it affects. The conference marks the second anniversary of the creation of a National Plan for Human Rights, launched by President Fernando Henrique Cardoso in response to accusations by international human rights groups of police abuses, torture, and widespread child labor. The government has put 50,000 children who work in orange orchards, charcoal kilns, and quarries for salaries as low as 87 U.S. cents a week back into school. It has also passed a law that criminalizes torture, but which limits the power of civilian judges to prosecute police. Meanwhile, Cardozo is calling for the prosecution and jailing of leaders of the Landless Rural Workers Movement, or MST, for organizing the looting of supermarkets in Brazil's famine-threatened northeast.
Guatemala's attorney general is suing several U.S. tobacco companies to recover the costs of treating smoking-related illnesses in the small Central American country. The suit, filed in Washington, D.C., is directed against Philip Morris Companies, Inc., which controls 70% of the Guatemalan tobacco market, and British American Tobacco Company. Although Philip Morris is trying to shrug off the challenge as political grandstanding, the suit is the latest in a growing docket of international litigation which includes cases from Canada, Brazil, and Nigeria. The tobacco giants are being fingered for unspecified damages under U.S. racketeering laws for conspiring for decades to conceal scientific and medical information about the health risks of its products.
And those are some of the stories coming out of Latin America this week. For Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal.
And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In other news this week, some major developments coming out of Colombia. Along with another massacre of seven peasants in Antioquia province on May 11th, a leading right-wing political figure and former defense minister was gunned down in front of his home on May 12th. This assassination led army soldiers to seal off the offices of a leading Bogotá human rights group the next day, while investigators conducted a two-hour search, scouring computers and carting away files. The army believes the Intercongregational Commission for Justice and Peace, Justicia y Paz, which is affiliated with the Roman Catholic Church, has links with the ELN, Colombia's other major rebel group. Justicia y Paz has been compiling sensitive testimony on human rights abuses in Colombia, and activists say the lives of witnesses could be endangered if it were to fall into the wrong hands. These events were overshadowed, however, by the announcement on May 14th that the U.S. was revoking the visas of several Colombian military generals. In response to the grave human rights crisis, the State Department is also recommending a suspension of all military aid to Colombia. We'll first go to correspondent Carlos Andres Perez, who is in Colombia and has this report about these latest developments.
Top Colombian military and police officials saw themselves stripped of their U.S. visas for presumed links to human rights violations. U.S. Undersecretary of State Pete Romero announced during an official visit to Bogotá on May 14th. One of the sanctioned officers, Army General Ivan Ramirez, was a member of the 20th Intelligence Brigade, which has been accused by human rights organizations of participating in the disappearance and torture of scores of human rights activists in Colombia. These latest events might be seen as a fitting culmination to a week in which Colombia's so-called dirty war seems ready to overtake an already violent electoral season. Hardline retired Army General and former presidential candidate Fernando Randazabal Reyes was gunned down May 12th as he was leaving his home in Bogotá. Prior to his death, General Landazabal had been working as political advisor to the presidential campaign of former Armed Forces Chief Harold Bedoya. Although no one has claimed responsibility for the attack, a number of theories have emerged. Security forces say it was an act of revenge by the National Liberation Army for the murder several weeks ago of prominent human rights lawyer Eduardo Umaña Mendoza. Others on the left say it might have been elements of the extreme right who seek to further destabilize the country. Current Armed Forces Chief General Bonnet indirectly accused the Washington Post and Human Rights Watch Director Jose Miguel Vivanco of being somehow complicit in the murder. And although there is little proof for either scenario, Army intelligence officers and Colombian prosecutors raided the offices of the Intercongregational Commission for Justice and Peace, a human rights NGO looking for suspects in the general's assassination. Soldiers and investigators conducted a two-hour search, scouring computers and carting away computer files. Justice and Peace, which is affiliated with the Roman Catholic Church, has been compiling sensitive testimony on human rights abuses in Colombia. An activist said the lives of witnesses could be endangered if it were to fall into the wrong hands. After immediate national and international condemnation, state prosecutors sought to distance themselves from the raid, saying that they were merely acting on information supplied by Army intelligence. Despite the escalation of political violence signaled by Landazabal's assassination, very few people here expect a major disruption of the upcoming May 31st presidential elections, where right-wing candidate Andrés Pastrana is losing ground to the independent campaign of former Chancellor Noemí Sanín Restrepo, and liberal candidate Horacio Serpa maintains a comfortable lead in the polls. In other news, a faceless tribunal has released two men accused of participating in the massacre of 107 people in the small town of Trujillo nearly 10 years ago. Colombian Attorney General Jaime Bernal Cuellar said the men were released because the statute of limitations for their crimes had passed since state prosecutors failed to file charges while the men were in custody. And although his office has called for an investigation of apparent irregularities in the handling of this case, few here believe that much justice will be served. For Our Americas, this is Carlos Andres Perez in Medellin, Colombia.
Now joining us from Santa Fe de Bogotá is correspondent Steve Dudley, who's been watching closely the reaction to these developments on the part of the human rights community. First of all, Steve, what has been the reaction of the Colombian human rights community to the raid of the offices of Justicia y Paz? Was this a major setback for them?
It is, in the sense that the community is both scared and angry at what happened at Justicia y Paz. They're scared because it was an almost immediate reaction after what had happened to Landa Sabel and showed the danger of the accusations that had followed the death of Landa Sabel, in the sense that the human rights community was put under fire. They were shown to be perhaps even an accomplice to what had happened to Landa Sabel. And then the reaction of the government came immediately after that. One version of what had happened was that the Justicia y Paz office was an ELN safe house for guns. Another version had to do with the fact that the Justicia y Paz may have played a direct role in the death of Landa Sabel. So they are very, very scared on the one hand. On the other hand, they're very angry. Angry because both of these accusations were completely unfounded. And The search and seizure of Justicia y Paz has proved to be a bit of an embarrassment for the government. They to an extent has shown the level of the crisis that exists within the military, in the sense that the Attorney General's office was acting on orders from military intelligence, but none of the military intelligence had been confirmed within the military itself. So the whole thing seems to have turned the human rights community into a very, very scared community, and the government into basically showing that it's just in complete crisis.
Steve, why don't you tell us a little bit about what Justicia y Paz's mandate is? We've referred to them as one of the most important human rights organizations, non-governmental human rights groups in Colombia. Why don't you give us a sense of what the work, what their mandate is?
Justicia y Paz works in different areas, really. They work in defense of human rights by publishing materials on things that have happened here. One of the most important of these things would be what happened in Trujillo a number of years ago, a municipality here where over 100 people were killed with virtual impunity by a paramilitary and drug trafficking alliance there. And these people were leftist activists. They were people who were involved in the church, etc., etc. Another thing they do is they work on educational projects. They deal with teaching people how to understand their rights here in Colombia, understand what it means to have a human right violated. Lastly, they deal in lobbying of sorts. They are internationally recognized organization, and so what they say about the situation here has a great effect on policy in different countries around the world, and most importantly in Europe and the United States.
Correspondent Steve Dudley was reporting from Santa Fe de Bogotá. Coming up next, an exclusive interview with the international spokesperson of the FARC. You're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. Colombia's presidential elections are scheduled for May 31st amidst increasing levels of paramilitary violence and a strengthening of the position of the country's main armed opposition force, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. The elections will mark the beginning of the end for the failed presidency of Ernesto Samper Pizano, whose 4 years in office have been marred by accusations that he financed his 1994 campaign with money from the Cali cocaine cartel. Ironically, his political ally and candidate of the Liberal Party, Horacio Serpa Uribe, is currently leading in the polls. Although he's not expected to garner enough votes to win in the first round, it doesn't look like any of his challengers have enough support to win in an eventual runoff, which would take place on June 21st. Nevertheless, the presidential campaign is turning out to be little more than a sideshow to the more serious issues of an escalating civil war, paramilitary terror, and the failure of the government to come up with any immediate solutions. The FARC rebels, meanwhile, are calling for a boycott of the May 31st elections, as they did in last year's municipal elections and this year's earlier vote for the National Congress. Earlier this week, I spoke with Marco León Calarcá, the international spokesperson for the FARC, from his headquarters in Mexico City. Calarcá first explained the position of the FARC vis-à-vis the upcoming elections.
Las FARC sigue adelante con su política de llamar al pueblo colombiano a la abstención, porque las
The FARC continues with its policy of calling on the Colombian people to abstain from voting in the May 31st elections because the elections in Colombia have nothing to do with democracy. The popular sector cannot truly participate in these elections because of the corruption and impunity that exists, and because of the results of the dirty war that has targeted all of the left, independent parties involved in legal political campaigns. Our call for abstention is echoed by the majority of the Colombian population, which rejects this completely undemocratic system by not turning out to vote.
In a sense, Calarcá is right in saying Colombians don't go out to vote in large numbers. Previous elections in Colombia have been characterized by abstention levels of up to 60%, which can be seen in part as a reflection of a population which has lost faith in the corruption of the two traditional parties and the overall failures of the political system. But in last year's municipal elections, threats by the FARC against people going to the polls was a big factor in the low turnout, where in some towns as little as 4 people actually voted. As in previous elections, the biggest issue this year is the possibilities for peace and the need to resolve the almost 40-year civil war. For Calarcá, only after the elections will they begin to consider real peace negotiations.
Esperamos que el gobierno que resulte elegido, que de todas maneras todo lo indica va a estar...
We hope that the new government that comes to power, which as far as we're concerned will still be characterized by a certain degree of illegitimacy, we hope that they will put forward serious peace proposals and that they have enough political will and power, which is necessary to begin a process of national reconciliation.
Earlier this year, the Samper administration announced that the government had agreed on holding a national peace conference with Colombia's other major guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army, or ELN. They said it was the result of secret talks held with the ELN representatives in Spain late last year. Immediately following the announcement, the ELN pulled out of the so-called peace conference, accusing the government of using these peace initiatives for its own political gains. Calarcá of the FARC says he wasn't surprised.
This whole episode once again demonstrates to us the lack of political will on the part of Mr. Samper, who, as expected, used the issue of peace for electoral purposes, trying to give more value, more oxygen, if you will, to his candidate, Horacio Serpa. For this reason, we insist that during this period of election campaigning, when everybody is going to try to take advantage of the issue of peace for political gain, no peace talks can take place, and we have to wait. We have to wait for a new government to begin talks.
Marco León Calarcá is the international spokesperson for the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC. I asked him to specify under what conditions would they begin peace talks with the government once the elections are over and a new president is sworn in, whoever that president may be.
Ahora, frente a un nuevo gobierno que nosotros no hablamos de nombres,
regardless of which government is in power, our proposal continues to be the same. It's what we've been saying for a long time and which hasn't changed at all in recent months. That is, the complete military withdrawal from 5 main municipalities, so that we and all Colombians can sit down and begin discussing the future of Colombia, the Colombia that we all want with tranquility and complete security. The government has to give us the necessary guarantees for this to happen. But they also have to dismantle the paramilitary groups operating in the country and put an end to the criminalization and discrimination against social protest.
The paramilitaries continue being the major obstacle to peace, both politically and militarily. Since last October, over 200 people have been killed in massacres carried out by right-wing paramilitary forces in different parts of the country. The latest massacre occurred in Mapiripan in Meta province on May 5th, where about 200 armed gunmen went on a 3-hour rampage to a remote village, killing at least 21 people. Witnesses say the killers had a list of targets, a standard practice of the paramilitaries who go after suspected guerrilla sympathizers in their campaigns of terror. One of the victims of the Mapiripan massacre was a 4-year-old girl. While the government condemned the massacre publicly, it has done little to combat the paramilitaries. At the same time, the National Paramilitary Umbrella Organization continues to maintain that it must be involved in any peace negotiation that takes place in the country. Calarca says this is unacceptable.
Uno, realmente, lo que vienen haciendo los paramilitares.
One, because what the paramilitaries are doing is not actually participating in a war against the guerrillas in the traditional sense. What they are doing is carrying out an indiscriminate campaign of terror against an unarmed civilian population, in compliance with an official plan, as part of the Army's security strategy. This is why we say that the paramilitaries are actually an extension of the Army, and in many cases, they are the armed forces themselves, disguised as paramilitaries carrying out these massacres against the Colombian people. Considering the situation, we believe that in an eventual dialogue for peace in Colombia, since the armed forces will be present in the talks as part of the state, they will be representing the paramilitary groups because they are part of their own project. This is why we reject sitting down at the negotiating table with the paramilitaries.
La reunión de los colombianos, al hacerse presente el Estado colombiano, está representando a los paramilitares.
The link between right-wing paramilitaries and the Colombian army is no secret. Human Rights Watch Americas, Amnesty International, and a number of Colombian NGOs have documented these nefarious connections. And it's not simply a thing of the past, as some have tried to paint it. The May 10th edition of the Washington Post reported that the U.S. government, the Colombian police, and the National Prosecutor's Office are analyzing the possibility that recent slayings of high-profile political activists may be linked to a Colombian army unit, the 20th Intelligence Brigade. In recent weeks, a prominent lawyer, a human rights advocate, and a leftist politician have been assassinated, and more than a dozen government officials, union leaders, and peace and human rights activists have received threats, prompting some of them to flee the country. An anonymous source told the Washington Post that, quote, the suspicion of the government and everyone is that it is people, past and present, associated with the 20th Brigade, unquote, who are responsible for the killings. Colombian military officials have denied that the army is responsible for the killings. Officials describe it as an informal intelligence network operating at the service of extreme right-wing and paramilitary elements. The Post reported that the network is suspected of collaborating with an unidentified number of past and present 20th Brigade members, and that some collaborators are believed to be unhappy with military leadership, as well as with government efforts to negotiate peace with leftist rebels. Police say there are similarities among the murders of Jesus Maria Valle, president of the Human Rights Committee of Antioquia Province, Eduardo Umaña Mendoza, a respected legal defender of political prisoners and union leaders, and Maria Arango, an activist and former Communist Party leader. The three were shot in their homes or offices by assassins, identified only as two men and a woman, who knew their victims' movements and wanted to show they operate at will. Their murders have alarmed many in Colombia, who are now seeing that nobody is safe from this violence, a violence which the paramilitary leadership said in a recent communique will not stop until the guerrillas sit down at the negotiating table with the government. I asked Calarca of the FARC to comment on this.
Somos conscientes de...
We are very aware of this development, and we are doing everything possible to protect the people, and that's why we forcefully denounce the role of the Colombian army in this kind of paramilitary violence. The fact is that you can't view the paramilitaries as an isolated phenomenon. That's one of the big mistakes made by public opinion, because they think of it as something separate, and they continue talking of three main forces, the guerrillas, the armed forces, and the paramilitary groups. But the paramilitaries are part of the army, part of the policy of state terror, where they armed them, financed them, trained them, and allowed them to develop.
Along with the paramilitary question, another factor causing alarm both within the Colombian NGO community and Washington-based human rights organizations is the increasing levels of aid being sent to the Colombian military in the name of the drug war. And while the amount of aid is reaching unprecedented heights, the rhetoric coming out of some sectors in Washington in terms of how that aid can be used is of greater concern to observers of Colombia. As we've reported in the past on Our Americas, the fine line between counter-narcotics and counter-insurgency continues to be blurred. This led the FARC to publicly declare earlier this year that U.S. officials working in areas of high conflict, ostensibly in anti-drug efforts, should be considered legitimate military targets of the guerrillas. Calarcá explained their position.
Nosotros hemos venido sosteniendo y diciendo que todas aquellas personas nacionales o extranjeras que se involucren.
We've been saying that all of those people, whether nationals or foreigners, who are one way or another involved in the war that's being waged against the people, would be considered military targets, since we take it upon ourselves to defend the people. This is based on the fact that the famous anti-drug aid is being used fundamentally in the counterinsurgency war, and that there is an increasing presence of U.S. advisors and military officials who are participating in this war against the people of Colombia. So this is what we want the world to know, and specifically the people of the United States, in order to develop a solidarity aimed at making sure that this does not occur, because there is no reason for them to aggravate the situation more for our people. And naturally, if this does occur, unfortunately, there will be tragic consequences, something we don't want.
De los Estados Unidos y lo que le estamos solicitando es que desarrollen la solidaridad para que eso no ocurra, porque es que no hay razón para que agredan todavía más.
The threats against U.S. anti-drug officials were put to the test after the kidnapping of four U.S. citizens who were captured during a FARC ambush outside of the capital in March. The four were apparently birdwatching in the highly conflictive zone and were held for a few weeks before finally being let go. The FARC had threatened to execute the four if they were found to be working with U.S. counter-narcotics officials. I asked Calarcá to comment on this.
Bueno, en primer lugar, es bueno aclarar que no fue un secuestro.
First of all, we must clarify that this was not a kidnapping, but a detention. It was a detention in order to investigate whether or not they were part of U.S. intelligence organizations operating in the region, to see if they were really involved in innocent activities, as we found out later, or were involved in some actions against the Colombian people through intelligence work. We think it is the fundamental right of the Colombian people to defend itself from external aggressions. And as long as the war continues to intensify, this will continue to happen. That is, the detention of people, until we can verify what it is they are actually doing.
Marco León Calarcá is the international spokesperson for the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. I spoke with him from his headquarters in Mexico City earlier in the week. And you're listening to Our Americas. Just one last note about Colombia. May 19th marks the first anniversary of the brutal assassination of Mario Calderón and Elsa Alvarado, two human rights activists from the Center for Research and Popular Education in Colombia. The two were killed, along with Elsa's father, Carlos, by paramilitary assassins who burst into their apartment in the middle of the night. A broad cross-section of Colombian civil society is organizing a series of events to commemorate their deaths, as well as the recent murders of other human rights and popular activists, which we talked about earlier. Similar events are taking place in Europe and throughout the U.S., including Washington, San Francisco, and New York. Their demand, to bring an end to the political violence and impunity, and bring peace with social justice to Colombia.
Amo la vida sin remedio, con sus días al sol de amigo.
And you're listening to Our Americas. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. NACLA publishes a bi-monthly journal, Report on the Americas. For more information, call 212-870-3146. And if you have any questions for us, send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. I'm Mario Murillo. Stay with us.
Amo la vida al llegar y al despedirme, siempre la voy amando mientras sueño.